I got an email from a United States Marine a couple of years ago. I get a lot of these emails. So I knew this guy was no sissy. He was a tough guy. But he was not writing me as a tough guy. He was writing me as a distraught father. He said, "My daughter was the top Christian student in her high school. In fact, she helped lead the youth group. And she won several scholarships from Christian organizations to go off to college." By the way, how many seniors do we have in here? We have any seniors in here? How many of you guys are going to college next year? Raise your hand if you would. All right. Well, this father said his daughter wanted to go to the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. UNC Chapel Hill. She wanted to be a Tar Heel. And she wanted to win the campus for Christ. Of course, it needs to be won for Christ. So she went there, and this father said about 6 weeks into the semester, I got a phone call from her. Her words devastated me. She said, "Dad, I don't believe in God anymore." "You don't believe in God anymore? What?" He said, "I got in my car. I drove 4 hours from Hickory, North Carolina, all the way to Chapel Hill. I sat down with her, and I got nowhere with her. Why don't you believe in God anymore?" And she said, "Well, I have this professor in my religion class, and he says we can't trust the New Testament. He said there are errors in there. And so, you know what, Dad? I'm an atheist now." He said, "Frank, is there anything I can do about that?" I said, "Well, did you ever get her any apologetics training?" "What's apologetics training?" "That's giving evidence that Christianity is true. Comes from the Greek word apologia from 1 Peter 3:15. Always be ready to give an answer or a defense for the hope that you have. Give reasons." And he said, "No, I never did that. I wanted to, never got around to it." He said, "Is there anything I can do now?" I said, "I don't know. You could ask her a couple of questions, though." "What are those questions?" And here are the two questions I ask everybody who's a non-believer. The first question is, if I ask you a serious question, will you give me a brutally honest answer? Everybody always says yes. Sure, go ahead, ask the question. Second question, if Christianity were true, would you become a Christian? I said to this man, I said, "Tom, if she hesitates at all, it's not just here, it's also here." In other words, she might not want it to be true. Let me tell you something. When you go to college next year, those of you that are, there's going to be a number of factors that conspire against your belief in God. Number one, you're going to be out on your own for the first time. And you might want to do what you want to do and not be constrained by what you think God is going to constrain you by, these moral requirements. Number two, you're not going to want to be some Bible thumper on campus. That's not cool. You want to fit in with everybody else. Third, you're going to have your professors, many of whom are atheists, try and talk you out of Christianity. So there's a number of factors that are going to conspire against you being a Christian. But remember this, that if you decide to leave the Christian faith, you're going to be adopting another faith. And as I hope to show you here today, a faith that has a lot less evidence behind it. Even atheists have a faith. They have a belief that what they believe is true. And what they believe is true really isn't true. There really is a God. Jesus really did rise from the dead. In fact, I hope to show you some evidence that that's the case today. But the first question I want to ask you is, why are you here? I don't mean why are you here in school today. We know why you're here in school. I mean, why are you here on earth? What is the purpose of your life? This is the interactive portion of the program. Why are we here? What's the point? Yes, sir. I want a real answer. Live and do what God has you to do. But that's assuming that God exists, right? What's the purpose of life? Yes. To make way for the next generation? Well, what about this generation? You know, the last generation said, "Let's make way for the next generation." Now you are the next generation. So what? Yes. Outside of God, there is no purpose to humanity. You are correct. There is no objective purpose. It's just a bunch of people who have an opinion that this is how we ought to live. Who's to say they're right? I mean, what's the real purpose of life? Is life just a glorified Monopoly game? Get a whole bunch of stuff now because when the game is over, it's all going to go back in the box. You guys ever played Monopoly? What do you do when the game's over? You may have hotels on Park Place and Boardwalk, but when the game is over, it just goes back in the box. Is that what life's about? You know, one preacher put it to his congregation this way. He said, one day you are going to die. And they're going to dig a hole somewhere, and they're going to dress you up in your best suit or your best outfit. They're going to put you in a box. They're going to lower you into that hole. Then they're going to throw dirt in your face and go back to the church and eat potato salad. That's it? That's the end of, that's all life means? You just take a dirt nap for all eternity and there is no meaning to life? You know what? If the atheists are right, that's true. That's it. You just take a dirt nap. And everything you do here on earth has no ultimate meaning. But the atheists aren't right, thankfully. There is a real meaning to life. And you know what? There's only four questions you need to answer in the affirmative to say that Christianity is true. Just four. If you answer yes to these four questions, you can show beyond any reasonable doubt that the Bible is true and that Christianity is true. What are the four questions? Here are the four questions. That's some pretty grooving music, isn't it? Yeah, that's actually from our TV show. We have a TV show every Wednesday nights at 9 p.m. and 1 a.m. on DirecTV channel 378. How many people here have DirecTV in their house? DirecTV. Okay, why not the rest of us? Come on, friends, don't let friends watch cable. If you want to get, I don't have enough faith to be an atheist, you got to get DirecTV. Actually, that's not true. If you have a computer connection, internet connection, go to that website right there, crossexamine.org. At 9 p.m. on Wednesday nights, and you can watch the show live. Right now, we're going through the Book of Romans on that program, and we put a lot of evidence into the presentation to show you why we think the Bible is true. We're also on Saturday mornings on radio. Somebody told me the station. There's one here in Fayetteville. It's 80, what is it? Anyone know? 88.7 Saturday mornings. If you're up at 10 a.m., most teenagers are not. Most teenagers get up at the crack of noon on Saturday. I understand that. But it's podcasted, so if you're not on your radio at that time, you can listen to it anytime. And what we do is we present evidence for Christianity, and we cross-examine ideas against it. Now, why are these the four questions? Does truth exist? Does God exist? Are miracles possible? Is the New Testament true? First of all, if there is no truth, if it's just true for you but not for me, or all truth is relative, you've heard these claims, right? Then this book can't be true. Of course, if there is no truth, then any book written by an atheist can't be true either. Right? So there's a problem with people who claim there is no truth. We'll spend a few minutes to point out there is truth. Second question, does God exist? There can't be a word from God if there is no God. If there's no God, throw the Bible away and every other book that talks about God. But I hope to show you today that there really is a God, that there is a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, moral, personal, intelligent creator out there. We're going to give three arguments, two scientific arguments, one philosophical argument that will show you that this God exists. Now, these arguments are in the Bible, but you don't need the Bible to know these arguments. In fact, we're not even really going to talk much about the Bible this morning. We're just going to talk about the evidence that God exists. Third question, are miracles possible? You can't have miracles in the Bible if miracles are not possible, right? If miracles aren't possible, the Bible's false. I hope to show you this morning that not only are miracles possible, but the greatest miracle in the Bible has already occurred and we have scientific evidence for it. Then the key question is the New Testament true? The New Testament doesn't have a prayer, If truth doesn't exist, God doesn't exist, or miracles are not possible. But if truth exists, God exists, and miracles are possible, then we can see if we have an accurate, historically reliable account of miracles occurring in the first century to a man named Jesus and his apostles in the 27 handwritten Greek manuscripts we now call the New Testament. We've put these individual works under one binding called the Bible, but there are actually many works collected. Did those people who wrote this stuff down about 2,000 years ago tell us the truth? Or were they written down by religious people who embellished it? They made it up. It's not really true. I think the evidence is quite strong that the evidence that they put here, the documents they wrote down in here, are actually telling you the truth. And you can be sure that the entire Bible is true then. You say, well, what about the Old Testament? I just see the New Testament up there. Is the Old Testament true? Well, if the New Testament's reliable, you get the Old Testament thrown in. Why? Who's in the New Testament that can authenticate the Old Testament? Jesus. If Jesus really is God, as the New Testament documents claim he is, then whatever God teaches is true. Jesus taught the entire Old Testament as the Word of God, so if the New Testament's reliable, you get the Old Testament thrown in. All right? Now, we're only going to breeze over a few of these arguments today. If you want to get more on this, you can get the book. It's called I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist. It goes into a lot more detail than what we can do here today. There's also a DVD set. In fact, Pastor Harris has a copy of it. He might show you some of the DVDs at a later date. You can go to our website to get more on this. It's called crossexamined.org. crossexamined.org. But we got to start right here at point one. Before we do, I want to point out that if I time this just right, we'll have absolutely no time for your questions. No, we'll have time for your questions, okay? So get ready. Pastor Sean said we're going to have some questions here, so get ready with questions. But we got to start right here at point one. You guys ready to start at point one? Does truth exist? Now, whenever you start talking about truth, you always have to start with Jack Nicholson. You adults will know what I'm talking about, right? That's right, because Tom Cruise had Jack Nicholson on the witness stand, and he said to him, Colonel, I want the truth. And what did Nicholson say? You can't handle the truth. Well, there's a lot of people in our culture that can't handle the truth. They're saying, you got your truth, I got my truth, there is no truth, all truth is relative. You've heard this before, right? Well, before we get into that, let's define what we mean by truth. Here's an easy definition of truth. Truth is telling it like it is. If I say, here we are in Fayetteville, North Carolina, that would be telling it like it is. If I say, here we are in Charlotte, North Carolina, where I live, that wouldn't be telling it like it is. Or we might say truth is what corresponds to its referent. If when referring to this book I say this is a black Bible, that would be true. If I say this is a white Quran, that wouldn't be true. You say, Frank, I came for this. This is so obvious. Why are you starting here? Because our first duty today is to state the obvious. There's a lot of people out there claiming there is no truth. And they're claiming that you can't know truth. So we got to define our terms. Truth is what corresponds to reality, or corresponds to its referent, or it's telling it like it is. Now, I'm here to say that all truth is absolute truth. Something that is true for all persons at all times in all places. There are no relative truths. You say, well, I can think of a relative truth. Like what? Well, today it's going to be warm here in Fayetteville. It's going to be in the 80s. And you're going to say, look, I feel warm today. But I'm sure the people in Alaska, where last month it was minus 83 degrees Fahrenheit, in some places in Alaska, they felt cold. That cold. That's relative. No, it's not relative at all. It's absolutely true for all people at all times in all places that today you feel warm, if in fact you really do. And it's absolutely true for all people at all times in all places that we're referring to the people in Alaska, last month they felt cold, if in fact they really did. Remember, truth is what corresponds to its referent. Now, when you say things like this, that all truth is absolute, people are going to claim that you don't know what you're talking about. In fact, they're going to claim things like this. There is no truth. Now, if somebody ever says this to you, you have a way of pointing out that they're wrong. And if you learn this way, this technique of pointing out why statements like this are wrong, you will become what is known as a fearless apologist. That's somebody who gives evidence for what you believe, evidence that Christianity is true. There's a surefire way of pointing out why this person is wrong. You simply have to ask this person one question. What question would you ask somebody who said this? Go. Is that true? Yeah, simply ask the question, hey, is that true? Is it true that there is no truth? Because if it's true that there is no truth, the claim there is no truth can't be true, but it claims to be true. Can you see this is a self-defeating statement? It violates its own standard. It's like saying, I can't speak a word in English. Yeah, didn't you just say that in English? Or it's like saying there are no sentences in the English language longer than three words. Or it's like saying my parents had no kids that lived. Or it's like saying my brother is an only child. Right? You get the idea. This is self-defeating. Now, what we're doing here is we're just applying the claim to itself. You look at the claim and you go, does that meet its own standard? If it doesn't, it's false. This is applying the law of non-contradiction. Do you guys take logic classes in high school? No? We got to get some logic classes in here. All right, we're working on it. All right. Because it's important, because this is false to say there is no truth. It claims to be true, right? Now, we call this in the book the Roadrunner Tactic. You can get the book to find out why that is. But this makes you look like a super genius, all right? If someone ever says to you there is no truth, you should just say, hey, is that true? How about this? Have you heard this? There's no such thing as absolute truth. If someone ever says that to you, you should apply the claim to itself. What would you say to somebody who said this? Yeah, is that absolutely true? Are you absolutely sure? Do you see that this is an absolute truth claim right there? It defeats itself. It's like saying, I can't speak a word in English. It's false. How about, oh, once again, you look like a super genius. How about this? It's true for you, but not for me. Have you heard this? Have you heard people say, oh, yeah, Christianity's true for you, but you know, Buddhism's true for me. What do you say to somebody who says that? It's true for you, but not for me. Yeah, that's right. Just say, hey, is that true for everybody? It's true for you, but not for me, true for everybody. Because if true for you, but not for me, is true for everybody, then true for you, but not for me, can't be true because it's true for everybody. Yeah, I know that can give you intellectual constipation if you think about it long enough. But that's because it's self-defeating. It's like saying, I can't speak a word in English. That would be like, suppose you came home with a bad grade. And your mom looked at your grade and said, you failed. You got a 40. It's very easy to get out of trouble. You just say, hey, mom, that's true for you, but not for me. Is she going to buy that? No, if it's true, you got a 40. That's true for all people at all times and all places when referring to you at that time. That's what you got. By the way, I go to a lot of churches and I ask people, hey, do you believe this book is true? You know what most people say? Yes. Then I ask them, why is it true? You know what answer I get more than any other? Because I have faith. Is that a good answer? No. Why? Does your faith change whether or not this book is true? No. Your faith doesn't change a thing about whether this book is true. Does your faith change whether or not God exists or Jesus rose from the dead? No, he either exists or he doesn't exist. He either rose from the dead or he didn't rise from the dead, regardless of what you think about it. You say, well, why is the Bible always talking about faith? Well, think about it. There are two kinds of faith. There's belief that, and then there's belief in. What's belief that? Belief that is getting evidence that God exists, that Jesus rose from the dead, that the Bible is true. That's what we call apologetics. That's giving evidence for this. But belief in is trusting in. It's once you know that it's true, then you trust in it. See, the better word in our culture today is trust, not faith. Because belief that is evidentiary, belief in is the will. James, the half-brother of Jesus who wrote the gospel or wrote his book called James, says that even the demons know that God exists, but they tremble, right? The demons know intellectually that God exists better than we do, but they don't trust in him. And in order to be saved, you got to go from just belief that into belief in. Because God's not going to force you into heaven against your will. If you don't want to, you don't want God now, you're not going to want him in eternity. So you can know that God exists and still be lost. You got to move to belief in. Now, most of the time when the Bible's talking about faith, it's talking about belief in. Trust in, trust in. It already assumes that you know that it's true. In fact, what's the greatest commandment? Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. Christians don't get brownie points for being stupid. Okay, we're supposed to know what we believe and why we believe it. In fact, when I first met my wife about 26 years ago, I got evidence that she would be a good wife. But all the evidence in the world didn't make her my wife. I had to take a step of trust in her to ask her to be my wife. And in a momentary lapse of judgment, she said yes. See? So there's a difference between belief that and belief in. We're giving you belief that today. And we can give you all the best belief that evidence in the world, but that doesn't mean you're going to be saved. You've got to trust in. How about this? There's no truth in anything but science. Have you heard this? When you go to college, you're going to hear this. Atheists like Richard Dawkins say this. What's the problem with the claim? Look at it. What is it? What? That's not science. That's exactly right. You simply say, is that a scientific truth? Can you go in the laboratory and prove that? No, you can't go in the laboratory and prove that. That's a philosophical claim. And what's often forgotten is that you can't do science without philosophy. Science is built on philosophy. The problem is many scientists are poor philosophers. In fact, I wrote an article not long ago. You can go to our website and get it. It's called Science Doesn't Say Anything Scientists Do. Science doesn't say anything scientists do. And it depends on the worldview of the scientist as to how they're going to interpret the data. All data needs to be interpreted. That involves philosophy. That involves thinking. No scientific data tells you what the answer is. You have to interpret it. And so when you go to college, you're going to hear people saying, well, we evolved from apes or, you know, common ancestor and all this. How do they know that? How do they know that? Does the science tell them that? No, science gives them data. Then they have to interpret the data. And quite frequently, they interpret the data based upon their preconceived worldview, which says there is no God and miracles are not possible. So the result, the way they interpret the data, is because they've already decided that's the way they're going to interpret it. We can get into this during the Q&A. If you want to talk about evolution, we can. Just bring it up. But I got to move on. I just want to point out here that this is a self-defeating statement. In fact, you know what? You can't understand the newspaper without philosophy. You can't understand the Bible without philosophy. You can't understand anything without philosophy. Now, I'm not talking about the kind of philosophy where you sit around and ponder whether or not you have a navel. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about philosophy when it comes to logic and thinking and ethics. That's what you need to do to interpret anything. How about this? Have you heard this? You ought not judge. First of all, logically, what's the problem with the claim? It's a judgment. So the next time somebody says you ought not judge, put your hands on your hips and say, then why are you judging me for judging? See, because that's what they're doing. Now, by the way, did Jesus say don't judge? No, Jesus did not say don't judge. Jesus said, judge not lest you be judged by the same standard you judge others. You be judged by that standard. So before you try and take the speck out of your brother's eye, take the log out of your own eye first. Then you'll be better able to help your brother. So is this a command not to judge? No, it's a command on how to judge. He's telling you to take the speck out of your brother's eye. That involves making a judgment. He simply says, don't judge hypocritically. If you've got that problem in your life, get it out of your life first, then you'll be better able to help your brother. But this is complete suicide to say, don't make judgments. You know, everybody in this room has made 100 judgments in the past 24 hours between right and wrong, safe choices from dangerous choices, good and evil. You'd be dead already if you didn't make judgments. The only question is, are your judgments true? In fact, in John 7:24, Jesus says, stop judging by mere appearances and make a right judgment. Although Jesus did save a very stern rebuke for people who were judgmental. And who were the judgmental ones? The Pharisees. And who were the Pharisees? They were the religious and political leaders of Israel. And Jesus went after them. Are you telling me Jesus got involved in politics? Yes. In fact, sometimes he was pretty caustic doing it. And if you don't think so, you just need to read Matthew chapter 23. You guys ever read Matthew chapter 23? Yeah, go read it one time. He's talking to the Pharisees, the religious and political leaders of Israel. What does he say? Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You strain out a gnat and swallow a camel. Oh, you look great on the outside. You're whitewashed tombs, but on the inside, you're full of dead men's bones. You go a mile to make a convert, and then once you make them a convert, you make them twice as much a son of hell as you are. How will you avoid being condemned to hell? What? Sweet and gentle Jesus said this? Yes, Jesus was not Barney. Okay?
Can't we all just get along, boys and girls?
No! He was tough sometimes. And so do we. We need to be tough sometimes as well. Now, there's many more of these we could talk about. Like if somebody says all truth is relative, you would say what? Is that a relative truth? If someone were to say you can't know truth, what would you say to them?
How do you know?
Yeah, then how do you know that's true? If somebody says no one has the truth, what would you say? Yeah, then how do you have that truth? You see, you can't get at relativism is false. Can't be true. So don't worry about relativism. It's false. It defeats itself. It's like saying I can't speak a word in English. This is also, by the way, sometimes called postmodernism. It says there is no truth. It's false. And by the way, when you go to college, you know where you're going to run into relativism and postmodernism? In the English department. In the journalism department. In the humanities. You're not going to run to it. If you take science, they're not going to say, oh, you just got your gravity, I got my gravity. Okay, they're not going to say that. They only say it in the... I mean, think about this. Do you have to believe something to make it true? No, everyone in here just doesn't have their own gravity, do we? I mean, do you have to believe something to make it true? I mean, do you have to believe in gravity to stay on the ground? Do people who don't believe in gravity float away? Hey, look, there's another one. Hey, if you believe, you'll come back. No. There's really truth out there, and you can know it. Now, this process of turning a claim on itself is an easy way for you to be a lie detector. We've been going through self-defeating statements here. Here's another example of a self-defeating statement. Check this out.
Now we're going to run a few tests. This is a simple lie detector. I'll ask you a few yes or no questions, and you just answer truthfully. Do you understand?
Yes.
Can everybody see that, Homer Simpson? That's a self-defeating statement.
All right.
All right, so first question, ladies and gentlemen. Does truth exist? The answer is yes. It's self-defeating to say it doesn't. Okay? Second question, does God exist? Now, we got to define what we mean by God. We're talking about a theistic God. We're going to give three arguments for a theistic God. What's a theistic God? A theistic God is a God who's beyond the universe, who creates the universe, and holds together the universe, but he is not the universe. A theistic God is kind of like a painter is to a painting. Michelangelo paints the painting, his attributes are expressed in the painting, but Michelangelo is not the painting. The worldview that believes God is the painting is called pantheism. I'm God, you're God, we're all God. You know pantheism.
Use the force, Luke.
That's pantheism. We're not talking about that. We're talking about a theistic God. By the way, when the Bible says you're made in the image of God, what does that mean? Does that mean you look like God? No, because God is an immaterial being. You don't look like an immaterial being. It means you're a person like God. It means you have mind, emotion, and will like God. You can think, you can feel, and you can want, or you have a will. You can make choices. That's in the sense you are made in the image of God. Now, there are three arguments for a theistic God that we go through in the book in great detail. I'm just going to briefly mention some of them here. And hopefully when you walk away from here, you'll say, well, there's good evidence that God exists. The first argument is from the beginning of the universe, known as a cosmological argument. Cosmological comes from the Greek word cosmos, which means world or universe. And it says if the universe had a beginning, it must have had a beginner. The second argument is the argument from design, known as the teleological argument. Telos is a Greek word meaning design or purpose, and it says if there's design in the universe and design in life like you, then there's got to be a designer. Now, these two arguments are scientific in nature. You can get evidence for these arguments by either looking into a telescope or looking into a microscope, which we will do. Yet the third argument's not scientific at all, yet it's the argument we've all known since we were very small children. And it's the argument from morality known as the moral argument. And it says if there's one thing morally wrong out there, like it's wrong to torture babies for fun, or it's wrong to murder 6 million Jews in a Holocaust, then there has to be a God. Why? Because if there is no God, then that's just your opinion against, say, Hitler's opinion, the leader of Nazi Germany in World War II, who killed 6 million Jews. If there's no standard beyond us, who's to say you're right and Hitler's wrong? There's no standard. It's just two opinions. But we all intuitively understand there is a standard out there, and if there is a standard out there, it can't be us. It's got to be beyond us. In other words, there has to be a God that establishes what's right and what's wrong. Now, we'll spend a little bit of time on these arguments. We're going to start here with the cosmological argument. And by the way, I use these words because you're going to hear these words again, cosmological, teleological, and moral. And I know we don't do it here at the two schools represented here, but and I know we don't do it here in this church, but a lot of times we try and dumb things down for young people. We ought not do that. Why? You see this presentation I'm giving to you right here? Same presentation I give at UNC Chapel Hill. Same presentation I give at Stanford University. Same presentation I give at Ohio State. Same presentation I give to junior high kids and high school kids like yourself. Why? Because you're smarter than most adults think you are. All right? You can track with this stuff just like anybody else. The problem is, if we try and dumb everything down, once you get out into the real world ain't dumbed down, is it? And you need to know the truth. So if you're worried about these big words, don't worry about them. You can handle it. You guys ready to go? The cosmological argument. This is the argument that many say points back to the big...
Oh, now some people are going here, you know, Frank, we're Christians. We don't believe in the Big Bang.
You guys don't believe in the Big Bang? I believe in the Big Bang. I just know who banged it. In fact, the evidence for the Big Bang is quite good. These are even atheists who admit this. This is Stephen Hawking, who says almost everyone now believes that the universe and time itself had a beginning at the Big Bang. Now, Hawking tries to come up with another explanation other than God, but he fails. He knows that space, time, and matter had a beginning. A colleague of his, Alexander Vilenkin, a Russian cosmologist, put it this way. He said, with the proof now in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. There is now no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning. Two interesting words in here. First word, proof. Very unusual for scientists to use the word proof. Normally they say the evidence points to, the evidence suggests. When they say proof, they think that the evidence is quite strong, and indeed it is. Space, time, and matter had a beginning. The other interesting word is the word problem. Why is there a problem that there was a cosmic beginning? Yes, because that gets too close to
the G word, God. They don't want to go to God, so they will do everything they can to avoid God.
In fact, Einstein himself, who came up with the theory of general relativity that said space, time, and matter were co-relative, that they came into existence together, Einstein didn't like that when he developed the theory back in 1916. He wanted the universe to be eternal, so it didn't need a God. So you know what the great Einstein did in order to avoid an absolute beginning? He put a fudge factor into his equations to avoid it, called the cosmological constant. And in order to do this, the great Einstein divided by zero. Now, what are you told in third grade? Never divide by zero. You can go straight to hell for that. Well, the great Einstein did it in order to avoid God. Later, he repented of that because he knew the evidence was so strong that the universe had a beginning. If it had a beginning, it must have had a beginner. In fact, this man, Robert Jastrow, was an agnostic astronomer of great credentials. And a number of years ago, he wrote a book called God and the Astronomers. On page one in the book, he says, I'm an agnostic on religious matters. What does that mean? He means he doesn't know whether God exists or not. He says, I don't know. But here's what he says on page 14 of the book. He says, the astronomical evidence leads to a biblical view of the origin of the world. The essential element in the astronomical and biblical accounts of Genesis is the same. In other words, he's saying, when you look at the science and you look at the Bible, they're the same. He went on later to say that there are what I or anyone would call supernatural forces at work is now, I think, a scientifically proven fact. Wait a minute. Why would an agnostic astronomer say it's scientifically proven that supernatural forces are at work? Why couldn't nature have created the universe? Nature didn't exist. That's right. There was no nature. There was no space, no matter, no time, and then it all leapt into existence out of absolutely nothing. So if space, time, and matter had a beginning, the cause must transcend space, time, and matter. In other words, the cause must be spaceless, timeless, and immaterial. Now, when you think of a spaceless, timeless, immaterial cause, who do you think of? God. In fact, it wasn't just Jastrow who said these sort of things. Every one of these guys I'm about to show you are Nobel Prize winners in physics. These are people that helped discover the evidence that the universe had a beginning. And by the way, all the evidence is in our book. I don't have time to get into it now. But here's what these gentlemen said. Arnold Penzias has said, the best data we have concerning the Big Bang are exactly what I would have predicted had I had nothing to go on but the five books of Moses, the Psalms, and the Bible as a whole. His colleague, Robert Wilson, said, certainly there was something that set it all off. I can't think of a better theory of the origin of the universe to match Genesis. George Smoot, who taught at UCal Berkeley, put it this way, there is no doubt that a parallel exists between the Big Bang as an event and the Christian notion of creation from nothing. Now, if the universe had a beginning, then it must have had a beginner. Either no one created something out of nothing, that's the atheistic view, or someone created something out of nothing, which is the theistic view. Now, which view is more reasonable? No one created something out of nothing, or someone created something out of nothing? I was at Texas A&M last year, and during the Q&A, an atheist stood up and said, oh, I think number one is more reasonable. I said, number one? I said, let's look at number two for just a second. Number two says, someone created something out of nothing. Now, that's a miracle, right? But at least you have a miracle worker. You've got someone. You've got someone creating something out of nothing. Number one is a miracle with no miracle worker. You've got no one. How is that reasonable? That doesn't make any sense. I said, you're denying the law of causality. What's the law of causality? That every effect has a cause. It doesn't say everything has a cause. There's got to be something that's eternal. There's got to be an uncaused first cause out there. Either the uncaused first cause is the universe or something outside the universe. All the evidence points to the fact that the universe had a beginning. Therefore, the uncaused first cause must be outside the universe. It must be spaceless, timeless, and immaterial. I said to the atheist that night, I said, the law of causality is the foundation of all science. If you want to give up on the law of causality, you've got to give up on science. Why? What do scientists do? They search for causes. What particular cause caused this particular effect? If you want to give up on the law of causality and say that the ultimate effect didn't have a cause, you might as well just give up on all science, because the ultimate effect is the universe. Where'd it come from? I said, to show you how seriously everybody in this room takes the law of causality, there is nobody sitting here right now that as you sit here, you are currently worried that a hippopotamus has appeared out of nothing in your dorm room and is currently defecating on the carpet. Right? You don't worry about that. You don't worry about it. You don't worry about that as we sit here, right? You're not worried that a raging Bengal tiger is going to appear right here out of nothing and start devouring people. You don't worry about that. Why? Because you know that things don't pop into existence out of nothing without a cause. Same thing is true about the universe. In fact, here's a question to ask an atheist. If there is no God, why is there something rather than nothing at all? If there is no God, why does anything exist? If the atheist says, well, the universe has always existed, you can give him the evidence that the universe hasn't always existed, which is all in the book. It had a beginning. If it had a beginning, it must have had a beginner. All right. There's more, much more in the book, but let's talk a little bit about the design argument. Okay? Not only did the universe explode into being out of nothing, it did so with extreme precision. And this is sometimes called the anthropic principle. Anthropos is a Greek word meaning man or mankind. And this argument says that the universe and life are so highly designed and fine-tuned that somebody must have designed it. If you were to change any one of a number of small factors about our universe, we wouldn't be here. It appears that there's a mind behind all this. And we'll start with Stephen Hawking, again, an atheist, who said this. He said, if the expansion rate of the universe was different by one part in 1,000,000,000,000,000 a second after the Big Bang, the universe would have collapsed back on itself or never developed galaxies. In other words, if you were to change the expansion rate, that infinitesimal amount, we wouldn't be here. The Big Bang was not a chaotic explosion. It was a highly fine-tuned event. Somebody was shepherding the Big Bang through stages. In fact, right now, the expansion rate of the universe is highly fine-tuned. You know, the universe is expanding right now. Somebody is expanding it. Somebody's holding the universe together right now. This is exactly what the Bible teaches, isn't it? In other words, the Big Bang was not just a horizontal cause. Like, bang, we started the entire space-time continuum. There's a vertical cause holding up the universe right now. If the gravitational force were altered by more than one part in 10 to the 40, we wouldn't be here. What's one part in 10 to the 40? It's a hard number to get our minds around, but that's one part in 1 with 40 zeros following it. You say, I can't comprehend that. Let me give you an illustration. Take a tape measure and stretch it across this entire auditorium. You see that wall over there? And let's take it to that wall, all right? And set the gravitational mark gravitational force at a particular inch mark on that tape measure. I know gravity's not measured in inches. This is just to give you a scale in your mind. If you were to move the strength of gravity 1 inch in either direction, we wouldn't be here. Except the scale doesn't go from that wall to that wall. The scale goes across the entire known universe. Billions of miles, trillions of miles. And you were to move the gravitational force 1 inch on that scale, we wouldn't be here. That's 1 in 10 to the 40 precision. I don't have enough faith to believe that that just happened by chance. In fact, there's only 3 possibilities. That happened by chance. That happened because of physical necessity, which isn't the case. Doesn't have to be here. Could be over here. Could be over there. Could be 1,000 miles that way. Or it happened by design. I think the best evidence says it happened by design. Somebody put it there. Also, if you look at our universe, we appear to be fine-tuned. There's a habitability argument here. Or I should say our solar system. Where are we in the solar system? There we are, a third rock from the sun, right? If we were just a little bit closer to or a little bit further away, we wouldn't be here. A little bit closer to, we'd burn up. A little bit further away, we'd freeze. We are what scientists call the Goldilocks zone. It is not too hot. It is not too cold. It is just right. Although the summers in Fayetteville can be a little warm, I understand. The axial tilt, 23.5 degrees. You change that slightly, we don't exist. The Earth rotation, 24 hours. Change that slightly, we don't exist. The size and distance of the moon from us. Change that slightly, we don't exist. If Jupiter was not in its current orbit, we wouldn't be here. Why not? What does Jupiter do for us? Anyone know? Yes, sir. It does keep us from drifting, but even more important, what does it do? It protects us from debris, meteors, and space junk. Why? Because its gravitational force is so strong that most of the meteors and all that stuff go to it rather than us. In fact, if you take a close-up look at Jupiter, you know what those purple marks are right there? Those purple marks are comet fragment strikes that are bigger than the Earth. Thank God for Jupiter. So if Jupiter wasn't there, we wouldn't be here. Same thing's true with Saturn, by the way. I don't know if you saw this. About a month ago, there was in the news a prediction that a meteor might hit the earth in 2040. I am rooting for Jupiter. You? Are you rooting for it?
Yes.
All right. Good. Good. In fact, you want to see the size of Jupiter? Check this out. There's Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Earth. Look at poor Pluto down here. You know, Pluto recently has been demoted as a planet. I don't know about you, but I think it's size discrimination. What do you think? All right, keep an eye on Jupiter. Take a look at this now. You can hardly see Pluto. All right, keep an eye on, you got the sun? Keep an eye on the sun. Here you go. Ooh, there's the sun right there. Jupiter is one pixel in size on this scale. Earth is invisible. Pluto, forget about it. This is Arcturus. That's another star in our galaxy. All right, you got Arcturus? Okay, watch Arcturus for a second. Here you go. Where's Arcturus? There's Arcturus right there to the left of the white star Regal. The sun is one pixel in size on this scale. Jupiter is invisible. Earth, Pluto, forget about it. Do you see this here? That's Antares. That's another star in our galaxy. Do you see this right here? Betelgeuse. If the Earth was the size of a golf ball, Betelgeuse would be 5 or 6 Empire State Buildings high. The heavens are awesome. This is just in our galaxy. The average distance between stars in our galaxy is 30 trillion miles. All that distance is necessary for us to exist here on Earth. If the distances were varied slightly, our gravitational forces would interfere and we'd be out of orbit and we couldn't live. Now, 30 trillion miles, how far is that? Far. Yeah, it'd take you at least 2 tanks of gas and a Toyota Prius to go 30 trillion miles. That is if the gas pedal doesn't stick. I was out in the Desert Museum in Tucson, Arizona a number of years ago. The Desert Museum at night. So you're out in the desert. And we were out there with a guide, and it was such a clear night, the guide said, "Wow, look how clear it is. We can see all these stars. In fact, it's so clear tonight that if we look up at 9:03, we're going to see the space shuttle in orbit." I said, "Oh, come on. We're not going to see the space shuttle. It's only 120 feet long. It's 350 miles up. We're not going to see it. Oh, me of little faith." At 9:03, the guide goes, "Look!" And we look up. In the sky, about 70 degrees above the horizon, there's an object coming out of the west, streaking across the sky relative to us about like this. I mean, it is really cooking. When it got right about here, it disappeared. I don't know whether Scotty beamed it up or what. But it was cruising across the sky, and then suddenly it was gone. Now, when the space shuttle is in orbit, the space shuttle is traveling at about 18,000 miles an hour. That's 5 miles per second. You got trouble getting to school in the morning? Take the space shuttle. 5 miles a second. Think about that. It goes around the Earth once every hour and 15 minutes, 25,000 miles. Now, I did a little calculation to figure out how long would it take us if we could get in the space shuttle and travel from our star, the sun, to another star in our galaxy an average distance away, 30 trillion miles. How long would it take us? At 5 miles a second. A couple days.
Years.
Months. Weeks. It would take us 201,450 years. To go from our star, the sun, to another star an average distance away, just in our galaxy, going 5 miles a second. Think about that. That means if you got in the space shuttle at the time of Christ and started traveling from our star, the sun, to another star an average distance away, At 5 miles a second, you'd be less than 1/100th of the way there right now. And we're going to explore space. No, we're not. We're not going anywhere in space. Who'd like to go to the next nearest star? We'll go. Get in, kids. Are we almost there yet, Dad? Another 200,000 years. Play some more Xbox back there. How many stars are out there? You know how many stars are out there? About equivalent to the number of grains of sand on all the beaches on all the earth. And I go from one grain of sand to another grain of sand going 5 miles a second will take you over 200,000 years. The heavens are awesome. February 1st, 2003, President of the United States goes into the East Room in the White House. They turn the TV cameras on. Every major network carries his address. Saturday morning. Why? The president looks in the camera and says, "My fellow Americans, this morning our country experienced a great tragedy. Upon re-entry into the atmosphere, the space shuttle Columbia burned up in the skies over Texas. There are no survivors. The Columbia is lost." The president then went on to quote from Isaiah chapter 40. Why Isaiah chapter 40? Because in Isaiah chapter 40, God is speaking according to Isaiah. And here's what God says in verse 25. "To whom will you compare me, or who is my equal?" says the Holy One. In other words, you want to know what I'm like? Here's a comparison. "Lift your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all these stars and named them one by one? Because of his great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing." The president then looked back in the camera and said, "The same God that created and named all those stars is the same God that created and knows the names of the 7 astronauts who perished today. While they did not return safely home to us, we can all now pray that they've all returned safely home." You want to know who God is? Most Christians have the wrong idea of who God is. We think God is like a big angel. God is not a big angel. You want to know who God is? Remove all limits from your mind. That's God. If he's an ounce of any attribute, he's infinite in that attribute. If he's an ounce of love, he's infinite love. An ounce of justice, infinite justice. Ounce of power, infinite power. He is the standard by which everything else is measured. Why is there a second commandment? "Thou shalt make no graven image." At least one reason why is there a second commandment. Because any image you make of an infinite being necessarily limits his majesty. You can't draw a picture of infinity. Everything you know in the world is finite. It's limited. What's the closest thing in our experience to infinity? The heavens. And even they are finite. How many stars are out there? Grains of sand on all the beaches on all the earth. 200,000 years at 5 miles a second between those stars. That's why Psalm 103 verse 11 says, "God's love to those that fear him exceed the height of the heavens above the earth." How high are the heavens above the earth? From our perspective, they're infinite. That's the point, even though they are still finite. The most important thought you have in your mind is the thought you have when you hear the word God. Who is God? He's not a limited, finite being. He is the standard by which everything else is measured. He has no limits. It's not just that when you look out into the heavens, you can see infinite design. When you look in to life with a microscope, you can see design. You see this? This is a one-celled amoeba, something that Darwinists say we all evolved from. You heard of the theory of macroevolution? From the goo to you via the zoo? Okay, this is the goo. In Darwin's day, this was not considered to be any big deal. They thought that maybe natural forces could come together, create a one-celled creature, and from that point, natural selection could take over, and voila, here we are. Today we know, however, that a one-celled amoeba is far more complex in design than virtually anything we've designed ourselves. A cell is like a city with all sorts of interacting processes and functions going on, as if somebody had designed this. It's a huge machine at a microscopic level. And to show you how designed a cell is and how much information a cell is, I got to take you to your breakfast table. How many people in here like alphabet cereal? You like alphabet cereal? Okay, let's suppose you love alphabet cereal. Let's go back to when you were a teenager. And you want to have a bowl of alphabet cereal one morning. You come downstairs to have a bowl, and you see that the box is knocked over on the table, and right in the middle of the table, the letters spell, "Take out the garbage, Mom." What are you going to assume? The cat knocked the box over? Earthquake shook the house? No, you're going to say that that's intelligent, designed from an intelligent being, Mom. Or let's suppose you're walking along the beach and you see in the sand, John loves Mary. What are you going to assume? The waves did that? Crabs came out of the water and made that message? No, you're going to say that had to be an intelligent person do that. Why? Because you know that messages only come from minds. They don't come from natural forces. Well, if that's the case, where does this message come from? DNA. Every living thing has DNA. It's a giant software code. And you have DNA. I have DNA. A banana has DNA. And the question is, where did all these letters come from? And everyone in here has a unique genetic code, unless you have an identical twin. You have a unique genetic code. Where does this code come from? Where do codes come from? Codes, it's like software. Where does it come from? It comes from minds. DNA is like take out the garbage, Mom, except it's a lot more complicated than take out the garbage, Mom. It's a lot longer. In fact, your DNA has 3 billion letters. Where did that come from? In fact, how much DNA is in an amoeba? And before I tell you, you know how big an amoeba is? An amoeba, you can line up several hundred amoebas in an inch. And in each one of the amoebas, there's 1,000 volumes of an encyclopedia worth of DNA in it. Now, to believe that that resulted by natural forces is like believing that the Library of Congress resulted from an explosion in a printing shop. I don't have enough faith to believe that. It seems that the first life requires an intelligent cause. In fact, you say, well, how do you know there's that much information in an amoeba? Some Christian tell you this? No. You know who told me this? The atheist Richard Dawkins. In his book, The Blind Watchmaker. This guy's the most popular atheist in the world today, and even he admits there's that much information in there. Now, remember how I said science doesn't say anything scientists do? He tries to interpret the data to say that God couldn't have done it or didn't do it. I think the evidence points much more clearly to the fact that there's an intelligence out there. And by the way, if you've seen the movie Expelled, you can see the end of the movie where he actually says, you know what I think the best argument or the best answer to where life came from? You know what he said, this atheist, Richard Dawkins? He said, aliens brought it here. Aliens! That was pretty funny, wasn't it? That's what I said, too, aliens! To which the interviewer, a man by the name of Ben Stein, said to Dawkins, he said, aliens? He said, Dr. Dawkins believes in intelligent design. Why? Because an alien's an intelligent designer. Of course, it doesn't answer the question, where did the alien come from? Right? Because there's got to be an... If natural forces can't create life here on this planet, why should we expect natural forces to create life somewhere else and then bring it here? By the way, this is not like the question, who made God? Why? Because God is outside the universe, and if he's timeless, he doesn't have a beginning. right? So nobody made him. He's the uncaused first cause. But an alien inside the universe had a beginning and was made. So Dawkins doesn't get away with this. In fact, let's go back to you in the beginning. Everybody was at this point 11 weeks in the womb. Now, question for you. Is this animal, mineral, vegetable, or human? That's a human right there. In fact, let's go back to the very beginning. Let's go back to when your mother and your father got together. Have you guys had this talk before? All right, I see some young people in here, so I'll try and be discreet. When your mother and your father got together, your father sent the entire population of the United States, 300 million soldiers, toward your mother's egg. And then there was a race. And you won. Don't let anyone ever tell you you're not special. You beat out 300 million others. You have blown away anything Michael Phelps has done. Now, seeing some of you older folks limp in here earlier makes it hard for me to believe you were the fastest soldier in the gene pool, but you were. You beat out 300 million others. Now, your soldier was 20 to 30 times smaller than a grain of salt, yet it contained half of the genetic information that makes you you. And your mother's egg was about the size of a period at the end of a sentence in an average book, yet it contained the other half of the genetic information that makes you you. And when your soldier and your egg came together, a new 100% genetic human being was created. You know, you have not received any more genetic information from that point till right now. In fact, there are only four things separating you inside the womb from adulthood: time, air, water, and food. Those are the same four things that separate a two-year-old from adulthood. Does this have implications on the abortion issue? Yeah, I think it does. We don't kill the two-year-old. Why do we kill the unborn child in the womb? Those are the only four things separating it from adulthood. Now, from that point till right now, a construction project of astonishing complexity began taking place. Cells began multiplying at a rate of 4,000 cells per second. Brain cells began multiplying at a rate of 100,000 cells per second. Some cells became brain cells. Other cells became heart cells. Other cells became lung cells. How did they know how to do this? Nobody knows. Some cells went so far across you to become what they needed to become that it would be equivalent to you today walking across the United States alone. And that construction project continues until right now. You just made 4 million new red blood cells. You just made another 4 million new red blood cells. You just made another 4 million new red blood cells. Knock it off! How do you know how to do this? I don't have enough faith to believe there's not intelligence behind that process. There is intelligence behind you. There's intelligence behind life. It takes more faith to believe that there's no intelligent designer than to believe there is. Now, we're running out of time here. I want to get to your questions. I just want to point out one thing. That in 1945, the Allied forces liberated the Buchenwald concentration camp in Weimar, Germany. I was just there about a year and a half ago. And they went through the front gate, which is still there. They looked to the right and they saw the crematorium about 100 yards off, which is still there. And they went down to the crematorium And then they looked into the courtyard attached to the crematorium, and this is what they saw. Brace yourself. Now, if there is no God, this is just a matter of opinion. If there's no standard beyond humanity, who's to say that Hitler was really wrong for doing this? That the Nazis were really wrong? That's just your opinion, if there's no God. Is this really wrong? I think we all understand it is. In fact, let me ask you the question. How do you know who's right and who's wrong? Mother Teresa was a great Catholic nun who cared for the poor in Calcutta. How do you know she was better than Adolf Hitler, the mass murderer? Well, let me ask you the question this way. How do you know which map of Scotland is better? Is it map A or map B? What would you need to see in order to know, in order to discover which map is better? You need to see what? A place called? You'd need to see the real place called Scotland, right? If Scotland doesn't exist, those two maps are meaningless. But since Scotland does exist, we can see map A, while it's not perfect, is a better representation of the real Scotland than is map B. In other words, we measure the two maps by an unchanging standard. That's exactly what we do when we compare Mother Teresa and Hitler. Mother Teresa wasn't the standard. Hitler wasn't the standard. There's a standard beyond both of them by which we measure that standard. And we say Mother Teresa measured up to the standard better than did Hitler. If there's no standard out there, there's no way to say somebody's better or worse than anybody else. Why? Because you don't know what better or worse is unless you know what best is. You can't say that somebody's closer to good if you don't know what good is. And so there is a standard out there, and that is God's unchanging nature. Now, there's a lot more to this argument I could talk about. Let me just mention one thing, and then we're going to take your questions. If there is no objective morality, then the Nazis were not wrong. I was at Michigan State a couple of years ago, and during the Q&A of an I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist seminar, an atheist stood up and he said, well, I don't think there, or I, we got into a conversation, I asked him the question, I said, well, you're an atheist, what's your standard of morality? How do you know what's right and what's wrong, or what is right and wrong? How do you judge that? And he said, there were two of them sitting right over here, two atheists. And the first one said, whatever the majority decides is morally right. I said, are you telling me that if you lived in Nazi Germany and the majority of Germans decided to murder Jews, that murdering Jews would be morally right? And he stopped, he blushed, and he went, yes. And his atheist buddy sitting right next to him looked at him and yelled, no! The kid knew in his heart the answer was no, but in order to be consistent with his atheism, he had to say yes. Truth isn't decided by majority vote. Morality isn't decided by majority vote. Secondly, if there is no objective morality, love is no better than rape. Freedom's no better than slavery. Tolerance is no better than intolerance. By the way, are Christians called to be tolerant? No. We're called to be loving. And sometimes in order to be loving, you have to be intolerant. Because if you don't stand against evil, that's not loving. See, we're called to reach out and help people. Tolerance says hold your nose and put up with them. Love says reach out and help them. And sometimes in order to be loving, you have to be intolerant of evil. And there's a lot of evil out there. If you're not intolerant of evil, should we have been intolerant of Hitler? Should we be intolerant of child abuse? Should we be intolerant of rape and theft? Of course. Religious crusades are not wrong. I always hear atheists saying, well, you atheists, or you Christians, you did the religious crusades, to which I always say, well, so what? What's wrong with that? If there's no God, there's nothing wrong with anything. Killing all atheists would be just fine if there is no God, because there's no standard of rightness or wrongness. But of course, there is a God, so it's wrong to murder people. And you can't complain about the problem of evil if there is no God. Why not? Why can't you complain about the problem of evil? Because there's no such thing as evil if there's no good. And there's no such thing as good unless there's a standard outside of yourself. And that would be God. So when people say, I can't believe in God because all the evil in the world, I always say, you wouldn't even know what evil was unless you knew what good was. And you wouldn't know what good was unless there was a God beyond yourself to define what good is. So evil doesn't disprove God. Evil may prove there's a devil out there, but it doesn't disprove God. In fact, the shadows prove the sunshine. What do I mean by that? In order to have shadows, you got to have sunshine. In order to have evil, you have to have good. Oh, you can have good without evil. You can have sunshine without shadows, but you can't have shadows without sunshine. You can't have evil without good. So evil doesn't disprove God. Again, it may prove there's a devil out there, but it doesn't disprove God. Hey, Jerry, would you type in 189? Enter. I want to show you this very short video on if God, why evil. Then we're going to take your questions, okay? If God, why evil. It's a minute and 46 seconds long. You got to pay attention because there's a lot going on. You ready? Here we go.
Is God good? If he is, why is there suffering and evil? Let's assume for the moment that God is all-powerful. This means that God can do anything that is logically possible. So he can create galaxies and subatomic particles and rainforests and you. But God cannot do what is logically impossible. He cannot make a square circle or a one-ended stick. So can God make a rock so big that he can't lift it? No. So what if, when God created human beings, he wanted them to be free? Freedom's a good thing, but if humans are to be free, they cannot be forced to obey God, because freedom without choice is like a square circle. It's a logical contradiction. No choice, no freedom. God didn't want robots. He wanted real people. The first humans endowed with the awesome power of free choice abused their freedom. The tragic consequences of their bad choice and our bad choices ripple across the world. God is responsible for the fact of freedom. But humans are responsible for their acts of freedom. But let's remember, we don't suffer alone. God will put an end to suffering and evil. And God became a man to suffer with us. God is good, and he wants real people like you to know him. But the free choice is yours.
Now, if you want to see that again, go to our website, crossexamined.org, click on videos. And it's there, okay? Because there's a lot going on in there if you want to see that again. All right? All right, any questions? Questions? By the way, before the first question is asked, just come on up to this mic right here. If you haven't noticed from those three arguments, just by way of review, the cosmological, teleological, and moral argument, you can show that there is a spaceless, timeless, immaterial, powerful, moral, personal, intelligent creator out there. From those three arguments, those attributes come out and show us that this theistic God exists.